Hey up, and welcome to the Strategy Sessions. My name is Andy Jarvis, and I am the host of the show. This is the Christmas special. It's been recorded on Christmas Jumper Day. You won't be able to see that if you're watching the video, because we're not using the video today. But you would see two out of three of us on this show wearing Christmas jumpers. The one who isn't wearing a Christmas jumper, you can find out about shortly when we embarrass Ian and tell you who it is. So why is it a Christmas special? Well, it's December, obviously, and we're going to talk about people, we're going to talk about marketing, we're going to talk about growing businesses, but first we're going to talk about Evolved as well. So let's get straight into that. I'm joined today by Sinead Hall and Ian McIntosh from Evolved in Newcastle, as you're about to hear when they start talking. So Sinead, hello, how are you doing? Tell us about what you do at Evolved.
Hi, I'm hanging on. I'm very poorly, so apologies for my voice to start off. I am the people person, and I'm hoping that I make the people's lives a little bit easier. That is, in a nutshell, what I do. I set the policies and the procedures for Evolved, but generally just support people day to day in their roles and direct the people strategy here.
Brilliant. And the other person with us is not wearing a Christmas jumper because he's heartless. Ian McIntosh.
Wait, how have I been the only person in the office not to realise that it's Christmas jumper day?
It's am I one of those Scrooge type bosses, aren't you? I think.
That's absolutely not. But I see why it comes across like that. So I'm Ian, co-founder, CEO at Evolved. What do I do? I ask myself this on a regular basis. There's multiple roles, but largely ensure that the company meets its commercial objectives is how I would sum it up.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you might be thinking, so we've got people and we've got chief exec with a very commercial type role. What the hell has this got to do with marketing? It's the Strategy Sessions podcast after all, Andy. But if you come back to XMO Marketing, where I run the show, the mission statement that we have here is strategy times people equals performance. So you can have the greatest marketing strategy in the world, but if you don't have the people to bring it to life and you don't do the right things with those people, it's not going to happen. And the final word in that of that equation is performance. Performance for most companies is about hitting targets and objectives. I mean, we can talk about saving the world. We can talk about doing great things. And many companies can and do have mission and purpose. But at the end of the day, you've got to sell something to generate the money to allow you to do those things. So unashamedly about people today, unashamedly about performance and targets and metrics. But as you'll find out in a moment when Ian tells you a little bit about his background, we might even talk a little bit about marketing too, especially search marketing. So Ian, tell us this story of Evolved, because it's quite a story.
The story of Evolved, okay. So I should probably give you a little bit of context to my background briefly, and then I'll get into Evolved. So my entire working career, probably even started during universities, was search related. So I've been involved in SEO from 2005.
Back when TVs were black and white.
Pretty much. It was fairly early days, and I was, making websites. I was earning, affiliate cash, basically. It was paying me more than my job at the time, which got me into SEO. And I went from that position to working at multiple agencies, again, on the SEO side. And then it came to 2014 when myself and my brother-in-law, who also had a very similar kind of background, agency side, a bit more on the PPC side, we decided that, if we put our heads together, we could probably do something in this space. And there was a lot of frustration around how campaigns were being run. It was still a little bit of a shady world back then, lots of gray hat, black hat type link building that, we found very frustrating. This might sound a little bit arrogant, but we genuinely thought that we could run better campaigns than the majority of campaigns that we were seeing at the time. So we thought, why not? We haven't really got that much to lose. We put £2,500 in each, which was basically enough to get a very basic website put live and some basic marketing material. No clients to rely on. We couldn't pay salaries for the first 12 months. So we were starting from, as close to nothing as you can get. And we've grown it over those 8 years to where it is now, which is, we were at 55, 60 people, £5 million revenue this year. We're in a pretty good spot.
So the question I want to ask, when you roll back to those early days and you said it was a basic website and some marketing material, my brain's going, what marketing material? Did you do flyers? Did you do banner stands? Are you talking PPC? What did you do?
No. So what we did was we produced some insight-led competitor reports. So we chose some sectors that we could kind of lean on previous experience working for other agencies, and where we had some insight. And we would just send the reports out to the chief exec, who might have been a head of search role, head of digital marketing, a digital marketing director, those kind of roles. And we set it up in a way that we could do this very cheaply and en masse. So we had a really good process behind the scenes. We had guys that we outsourced the work to, that would do the data collection. We would then print the reports off, like physically send them out. And we had my bedroom was full of just stacks of A4 envelopes. And we would be sending hundreds of these out, knowing that, you know, this is just a numbers game, but it was costing us, you know, 57 pence or something per envelope. It wasn't expensive at all.
If you just imagine for a moment, if you're listening to this podcast, the look of absolute horror on Sinead's face then when Ian said, my bedroom was just full of stacks of, and I paused for a moment and was doing a strange thing with his hand. And there was just this moment of, where is this story going? And are we going to get cancelled? So direct mail, which even in the marketing world in 2014 was a dirty word, but I love it. I love direct mail. And it was successful.
It worked really well, and it was an incredibly exciting time because, like I say, when you've got no money, to receive one lead in a month is a massive deal, and you will then throw everything at that one lead to slowly get the ball rolling. So it was really exciting. I still remember, you know, we've got lots of stories from that period of time, but I remember that very first lead and converting it and then realizing, okay, now we can scale this up and now we can do more and all the rest.
And that, I had a guy on the show, Pep Leia, on the show a couple of episodes ago, and he's based in America, but had a really simple thought process. He's like, scaling from a couple of people to 10 people is really easy. I actually disagree with that, but he said, it's really easy to get to 10 people. But that's where a lot of companies stop, because they can't break through that point. Now, you've gone from two of you in a bedroom, effectively, sending out bits of direct mail, doing a lot of the shoe leather stuff yourselves, to 55, 60 people, a swanky office in the middle of the Toon. I must say, very swanky. I've been inside it. It's lovely. And, you know, what were the kind of stages within that growth that took you from 2 to 10, 10 to 20, 20 to 40, 40 to whatever? What were the couple of things that stand out?
Yeah, there are lots of different stages. I mean, the key ones, I'd say, that 2 to 10, 15 people. So obviously, starting off, you are doing everything from, you know, sales, marketing, admin, the actual campaigns themselves, client communication. You haven't got a client services team to lean on. You know, so you're wearing multiple hats every day. And then obviously with time, you're then starting to distribute these hats to the members of the team. And even when we were at maybe 15 people, I think myself and Dave, the other co-founder, were still quite heavily involved in the running of the campaign, because we started with no money, which meant that we couldn't easily go out and hire really senior people. It would be very difficult. Well, first of all, it would be difficult for us to attract those people, because we are a little bit of a nobody, you know, no reputation, no employer brand whatsoever. So we were generally looking at midway to juniors, which meant that we then had to act as the senior on the account. And it wasn't until, I would say, we got to maybe 25, 30 people that we really started to be able to hire, like things like heads of department, where you were looking at people who were more kind of heavyweight in the industry. So I'd say that was the early stages. We were doing everything. Mid stage is when you're starting to give kind of more leadership roles within the company, starting to establish a little bit of a senior leadership team, maybe it's one or two roles in there. Myself and Dave then taking more of a strategic view on accounts. You know, we might still be attending review meetings, that kind of thing. And then almost to whisk forward to the, you know, where we are now, you know, I would say the last year or two has been entirely about the senior leadership team. Building that out, making sure they've got the right kind of mentorship, skill sets, training, which has then allowed us to take a step right back from the day-to-day, which is where we are now. And we might still get involved in the odd client meeting here or there where we've got a historic relationship. You know, we do still attend these. But can the business function and continue to grow without our involvement day-to-day? Then yes. So
there's a big personal challenge in that as well, isn't there, in going from having a hand on the rudder at all times and knowing every client by name, every member of staff by name, being the SEO head, being the finance guy, being whatever, to now having a team and looking around at 60 people and going, what's he called again? And not, you know, not knowing everyone's birthday and all that. And then being involved in different things. It's a challenge, isn't it, to reinvent yourself as well, not just the business.
Absolutely. And I think this is the one thing I've probably struggled the most on. Because I am by nature a complete control freak. So I need to know everything about everything, whether it's an individual in the team, whether it's a client campaign. Like the more information I'm armed with, the more comfortable I feel. Mm-hmm. As you start to step back, that obviously becomes less and less, and you're relying on others and their decision making. And, you know, that puts you often in an uncomfortable situation. And then you're in a situation where you can't, or you don't want to probe too much, because that might suggest that you don't trust the team or the decisions that are being made. But at the same time, you've got this thing in the back of your head, which is saying, yeah, but you really need to get to the bottom of this, because what if it's a bigger issue, or, you know, do you need to be involved? So that stepping back, it's required a certain kind of mindset change, which I still don't think I've fully got to grips with, to be honest, but I'm trying hard.
I'm just going to jump in, because this is exactly what Ian's talking about, is as a leadership team, we are also trying to do that. Now we're established with the rest of the team. So one of our values is trust. And we, as Dave and Ian have stepped away, we have really, really, I guess, supported them to trust us. And we're now really struggling, because we're now having to push a lot onto the wider team so we can do the leadership stuff. Mm-hmm. And it is about that, allowing people to learn from their failures. And I feel like that is something that we are trying to establish more and more with the team. We really had it back when I joined, and it's something we talk about at the minute openly with the team, that the culture has changed and we've lost that intelligent failure a little bit. People don't, you know, take as many risks. And that's something, as Ian and Dave have stepped away, they've had to try and trust the senior leadership team that we will make mistakes, but we'll rectify them in the right way. And as a senior leadership team now, we're trying to change our culture slightly, because we've kind of gone off in the wrong direction. We've been not as trusting as we should have been. We've not let people fail. We haven't taken as many risks, and we're trying to push that back on people and say, you know, take the risks, you know, take the reins. And that has been really challenging for not just Ian and Dave, but us as a senior leadership team as well.
I know when I look back at my career, there's a couple of really key moments where I learned quite a lot. And only one of those is from a successful thing. All of them are from when I've fucked something up and, you know, wanted the ground to open up and swallow me. And there is that sort of safe failure bit where you have to let people feel that that mistake and understand it. And then I evaluate it and go, right, okay, what is the problem with that? So what I want to talk about, I'm going to come back and ask you later on to tell us about a mistake you've made in your career. We'll do that later on, so you can have a little think about one, because it's great to talk about them. But Sinead, tell us first of all a little bit about your background and what got you, know, what you did before, and then when did you join Evolved, and what does it look like?
So I started out in a family business. I worked for my dad and his partner for 9 years. I had children really young, and I didn't really focus on my career as such. Didn't a business apprenticeship, didn't really know where I wanted to go. Kind of fell into HR. I feel like a lot of people fall into HR. Wanted to go out on my own and, you know, be established and have my own career as my children kind of got to about 3 and 4. And I went into oil and gas. Really, really random. Don't even know how I ended up there, but lots and lots of people problems in oil and gas. And then I moved from oil and gas to End Clothing, which was completely different again. Started the HR team there with a couple of the girls, all early into kind of the advisory roles. And we by the time I left, I think the team was at about nine, had a director of people, was just going in a completely different direction to where I wanted my career to go. A lot of employee relations, disciplinaries and grievances, a lot of the sad side of HR, I guess. And I was managing the marketing, the tech team. So the tech team was based in London. The marketing team was based in Newcastle. And I really enjoyed it, but it wasn't challenging anymore. And this role came up with Evolved, and it sounded really creative. A lot of employer brand stuff to get into, you know, employer voice, listening to people and really creating an employer of choice in the UK. So that was the opportunity for me. And obviously, luckily enough, I was paired with Ian and we kind of hit it off straight away and didn't need a second interview and really, really shocked. Got a call straight away that afternoon, you know, they want to offer you the role. And it was in the beginning of 2020. And I actually joined Evolved. So the day that I left End was about 5-6 o'clock on the Friday that Boris shut the country down. And we were, you know, panicking. We had a warehouse. We were doing things to make sure everyone was safe. And I was like, I need to get home. I don't work here anymore. And I have a new job on Monday. And my children and husband are at home. And I need to make sure they're safe. So I joined Evolved completely remote. Met Ian on the Monday morning, sat as far away as we could in the office, sat down with my new laptop, and Ian just chucked all of this stuff at us and was like, there's your first month, tell us how you're going to react to it.
I was happy as Larry at this point, because I thought, thank God, I'm not the one that has to deal with all of this now. Sinead, here we go, it's going to be a roller coaster. Yeah.
And Ian, believe it or not, was still planning on going skiing and did the next day as well. So this was like Boris shut the country down, shut all the schools down and everything on the Friday. This was the Monday. Ian went skiing on the Tuesday.
Horrible,
very
man.
Optimistic.
It's a very difficult, thinking back to that time. I mean, now we're a couple of years away from that. There's a lot of things that look like stupid ideas and stupid things that we did, and you know, sometimes we went too far in lockdown, sometimes we didn't go far enough quick enough, but you know, thinking back, there was just a whole pile of confusion going on back then, just this whole mess of stuff that nobody could work out. So having to start a new job in a new company as the people person that everyone's looking at, I mean, that almost sounds to me like the worst of all worlds. Or was it the best of all worlds, because there was so much chaos? Everything you could do is going to bring light to it.
So the biggest struggle for me is I'd been planning for a good couple of months before I joined what I was going to achieve when I joined. And that plan, this was going to be my first strategic role where I owned the strategy and could create this fantastic place to work for people. And all of a sudden I was dealing with people over Zoom, which, you know, I'd worked with Slack before, I'd worked with Zoom, I'd been in the techie environment. But it was different because I couldn't build the relationships that I wanted to build. If anyone had a double, so, you know, we had two Louises. So I struggled with, well, which one's which and how do I build a rapport with each of them? And it was just, I guess, finding my footing within Evolved and understanding the culture virtually was really, really difficult, especially when I hadn't been exposed to the digital world as such. You know, it's a very different beast in terms of how digital companies look after their people. And I'd worked for some great companies that had looked after people before, but this was just for, you know, I would question things with Ian, Dave or Tom, and they'd be like, just do it. If it's for the greater good, just do it. And that for me was really refreshing. But at times it was almost like I couldn't really do what I wanted with people, because I wasn't in the same place as them. And that was the difficult part.
It's amazing how with all the world famous and amazing strategists that have written books and research papers on strategy, that probably the most quoted person on strategy in the world is Mike Tyson, which is everyone has a plan until you get punched in the mouth. And it sounds like that's what you mentioned. You had a plan and then COVID punched the plan in the mouth and everything had to go from there, right? So you picked yourself up and you got through to it. But what have you, not so much what have you learned over time, or maybe over your career then, in terms of developing high-performing teams and high-performing people? Because Evolved are still performing and still evolving, but still award-winning and doing great things over and over and over again. That's a really difficult thing to do. So what are the things that you've both been involved in setting up and doing that helps to set that high-performing bar while still allowing failure, but, you know, keep it going constantly, because that is really, really difficult.
I think the biggest thing for me from joining was just I had a great sense of who we were, and what I wanted to come in and do was do, you know, culture audits and align our values to mission and vision. And that was really, really difficult. We did it. We did it within the first year. And it was something I was very keen to push on with, because we almost had this sense of everyone knew how we worked. We didn't have the policies or the red tape, but everyone kind of got it. And for me, it was just, as we grow, if we want to keep that, we have to set what that is and set that expectation. And we did. We did value sessions and we aligned them and we got them on our induction. And, you know, it was all shiny and new to people, but it was still very much just who Evolved was. But for me, the biggest, I guess, learning in my career is, and I don't think unless you're a people professional, you feel that they make such an impact. I know Ian, Dave and Tom do, and a lot of other digital agencies do, but just setting the values and who you are and really giving people alignment to what you do. If you don't, people just work autonomously in the wrong directions. And I think we are good at that. When we do lose our way, people do now claw back to, well, actually, if we stick to the values, we can't go far wrong.
Culture eats strategy for breakfast. That was Peter Drucker, wasn't it, who said that?
Yeah.
He's probably right.
Absolutely right. And I mean, the high performance culture stuff, you know, I'm not saying we've got all the answers. You know, this is something that we are working on. But it does go back to what Sinead was saying. It's you've got a team who are all on the same page with regards to what really matters, which is the values. And everything else just feeds off that. The culture side, it's a really interesting time to be speaking about culture at Evolve, because we just did our big annual meeting. Was it a couple of months ago now?
Yeah.
And I spoke to the agency for about an hour about culture and how I think we need to have a bit of a direction change. So just for context, I think this will be quite interesting to anybody listening. We put out an anonymous survey to the entire agency, and we asked everybody to score between 0 and 10, how good they felt the culture was at Evolved. And the average score we got back was 8.1. So very high. Everyone seemed to be really happy with the culture. Mm-hmm. There was the odd outlier here and there, but you know, nearly 60 of us, so I wasn't reading into that. The score that I gave the culture was a 4 out of 10. And that is because I think there's a massive difference between a happy culture and a top performing high performance culture. And you know, I think one is a prerequisite to the other, but I didn't feel, despite everything that's been achieved and you know, we've done very well, I still feel like there's a way to go to really be like an elite high performance culture. And I think that's what we're now focused on trying to drive forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's the link between sport and business, I think, is hugely overplayed. And I say this as a massive sports fan. I spend, when I'm not working, I'm watching sport. That's generally the two things I do with my life. But I think the link between sport and business is overplayed. Driven often by retiring sportsmen and women, because they love getting paid to come and tell people how to do it. But the one thing that is useful is that sport has a really quick feedback loop and a very public feedback loop. So success and failure is acted out on screen weekly for a lot of sports. You know, so if you're in a Premier League football or a rugby team or something like that, you're playing weekly or twice a week. And there's a really quick way for people to see, is this a high-performing culture that's leading to success or failure? So you get a really quick, like if you're pitching for business and it's a six-month window, or you know, I've worked with some companies who have a sales cycle which is 18 months to 2 years, right? You don't get that every 4 days performance cycle, yeah, about how you're performing. So sports stars do have a real great insight into small changes, because they get really quick feedback on whether that works. That's quite a long intro into saying I do occasionally listen to either ex-sport stars talking about what they've learned and how it's helped them in business afterwards. And there was something there about Sam Burgess, who's the ex-England rugby league captain, went to Australia, became the world's best player over there in a place where they don't really recognise English players as any good, came back to play rugby union for England, and also so really great player, succeeded in every metric of the game. And the one thing he said was, he liked his teammates, he loved them, and he was mates with most of them. He said, but the one thing he realised when they lost the grand final one year was, I'm not here to be liked. We're here to win this trophy. And not winning the trophy was a failure. That's what we set out to do. And we came second, not by much, but we came second. So we failed. The whole season, therefore, becomes a failure. It doesn't matter what we've done, we failed. We need to stop being best mates and start being critical, positively critical with each other about how do we improve that culture? How do we change that direction? So it seems like you listened to the same Sam Burgess interview as well to get that insight.
That's exactly it. I mean, I think I spoke about healthy conflict for about 10 minutes, didn't I? And the fact that what really underpins that performance culture is psychological safety within the team. So anybody can say say anything to anybody, regardless of role, team, you know, personality, all the rest of it. And then what really underpins psychological safety is trust between everybody. So, you know, they know that, you know, it's just, they'll be listened to, they'll be respected. You know, people might disagree with you, that, you know, that's always going to happen. But nobody should ever be afraid to challenge anybody on anything, you know, whether it's being accountable to results, deadlines, you know, processes not being stuck to. Because, you know, I was hearing stories where there would be a meeting taking place, but somebody was afraid to speak up in the meeting because they didn't feel like, you know, they'd be listened to. And it's that kind of thing, which might sound small, but spread across, you know, a large number of people, actually, it's quite significant, and it points to a cultural problem.
Yes.
So how do you then bed that change in? And is that what you and Sinead have been working on since that meeting? And say, like, okay, we know what this is. What does that actually mean in practice?
Yeah. And it's a large project for the people team at the minute. And it's not going to change overnight. It is going to continue to change as we add new people into the team. I think the biggest thing that we had to say to the team when we were talking about culture is, we know it's not where we want it to be anymore. We are taking accountability for that too. COVID, although we, you know, we like to blame it, we don't like to blame it. We've got hybrid people. We've never had those before. We're building relationships with new people that don't have the history of the team. And trust us when we say we're doing this for the greater good. So there's a lot that we're going to have to do, and it's not going to happen overnight. It does, you know, align with our values and who we are, but we need to take a new direction. If we want to keep all of this good stuff, all of the perks, all of the social time that we have together, all of the relationships, the involved committee, and everything we do extra for people, come with us on this journey. And the truth is, not everybody will. We have people who've been with us a very, very long time, and they just get evolved. They get who everybody is. They get, you know, what we want to create. You don't have to show them the strategy because they've been here from day one. But we also have people like me who haven't been here from day one and just get it from, you know, having the relationships internally that we need to have to understand who Evolved is and where Evolved's going. And it is going to probably take about 2 years to get us to that high performance culture. It's not going to happen overnight.
And that's okay as well. If people leave, isn't it? You know, it's if they don't like the culture anymore, because the, you know, cultures change in places, and some people like the first one, they don't like the second one. Other people, you know, and vice versa. And that's okay that happens. That not everyone who starts the journey with you finishes it with you, as long as you treat them with the values that you have of trust and respect and everything else along the way.
And we've lost people during 4-day work. As an example, we brought 4-day work week in. We had two people who said, yeah, look, on the face of it looks great, but it just doesn't fit my life. One person needed a lot of structure. They said they struggled with, you know, not being online at 9 o'clock in the morning and having someone tell them exactly what they needed to do every day. And the autonomy was just too much for them. They needed more structure. So they left. They wanted a 9-to-5 where someone, you know, micromanaged them and told them how to do their job. They openly said that during an exit interview. We had another person who said, it's just not for me. I have this great family and I want to balance my hours across 5 days. We do a 32-hour work week. I'm happy with that, but I'm having to cram in more you know, albeit an hour extra a day, they didn't, it didn't suit their lifestyles, so they left. And that's fair enough. It's not going to suit everyone. But it's about making it fit for those and having a conversation with people initially to be like, well, how can we make it fit? You know, not everybody has to do it this way, or, and just showing that degree of flexibility as well.
The 4-day work week, is, you're not part of the national trial, are you? You were there before this. But there's a little bit of noise. It's fair to say that not every business owner is a fan of the 4-day work week. And there's some interesting discussions going on there. You've obviously got perspective of, you went for it. And I know, you talk us through, Ian, the process of getting there, because it wasn't just you woke up one morning and went, we're doing the 4-day work week now.
Yeah, no, I think this is a really simple one from my perspective, for anybody that runs or owns a business. There's very few policies that you could bring into a company that could improve people's well-being, improve productivity, have a general fantastic halo effect around everybody's lives and their friends and family. And it's got a lot of research to back up this as being a positive thing. And that was a lot of research when we implemented it. And since then, you know, there's been additional trials and whatnot, which is all saying exactly the same thing. So my question would be, given that there's all of this research and the upside is huge, what does it say about the business leaders who are not prepared to take that risk? Because to me, the risk is fairly minimal. You know, you could run it as a trial. You know, there's lots of ways to mitigate risk. And I mean, to be honest, you know, we've had to go through a bit of a learning process as we've implemented it. So, you know, nobody would expect it to be perfect from day one. But given the upside, you know, I would question the mindset of the people running the companies, you know, how forward thinking they are, all the rest of it, because, you know, there's evidence. It's not a matter of opinion anymore.
I think we live in a country where evidence and opinions are often confused as the same thing. They are not. But you only have to look at sort of seismic political events of the last decade, Brexit, where you may find that, you know, the emotional, slightly irrational approach of, you know, just saying the same thing over and over again because it's what you believe, when it crashes into the facts of the situation, emotion tends to win that debate, you know, and the opinion tends to outweigh the fact. It's a terror, you know, we are unfortunately a bit of a stupid species, sadly, for all our success. We are a bit daft that way. That's that wins.
I think it's under, sorry, go on. I was going to say, I think it's underpinned a little bit by this kind of hard work type hustle culture, where if you're deemed or seen externally as working less or not doing a 60-hour week and working weekends, that somehow you are providing less or being less productive, or, you know, you don't deserve success, which is absolutely, you know, nobody...
It's shite.
Any reasonable intelligence would consider that, you know, to be a fair opinion. I mean, Sinead would tell you, myself, Dave and Tom, well, prior to lockdown, it would be rare that we would be in the office before 10 o'clock. Like, very rare. It was like, it was a joke. Like, we normally came in for about 10:30. You know, we were not first in the office last hour. We were the complete opposite. We were normally last in the office and first out.
You know, so I'm an early morning person, and I'd be sending Tom emails. We'll talk about with the fact we've worked together. I'll be emailing Tom at like 8 a.m. I am an early starter, and he'd be like, "Why does no one ever get back to you? It evolved until 11. It's like, because nobody's there."
Yeah.
When I first joined, this was one of the biggest things that I struggled with, because I'd put a meeting in with Tom for like 10, and Tom would be nowhere to be seen. 10 o'clock in the morning. But that was just the culture. But then everyone's, you know, it's everyone's preference, and that's the thing. Like, some people are online late. So what I was just going to jump in with before is, I struggle in my HR head with the mindsets of people who don't think it's possible to make the work lives of others better. So I've spoke to loads of people since we've done the trial or moved to permanent, who are just like, you know, well, we have a call center, we have a warehouse, it just doesn't fit. It does fit. Make it fit. Make your rotas fit. Alternate your hours. Like, if you want to genuinely make the lives of your people better, Where's the red tape? Remove the red tape and make their lives better, because people will work harder for you, work better, work smarter. I mean, I do have some stats prepared, because I think, honestly, 4-day
work. This is what we like.
So controversial, but we have the evidence now because we've done it for so long. But it's just so frustrating when you speak to people who are like, we just can't implement it, or we can do it for the office staff, but we can't do it for the warehouse, or we can do it for the whoever, but we can't do it for customer services. And I'm like, yes, you can. I just 100% of our team feel that it's improved their lives. Like, we've surveyed all the way through this. I mean, we've been doing it permanently now for a year, Ian. We did a trial from August to March, and then from March onwards it's been permanent. So it's massively impacted our people in a positive way. But from an impact on clients, we work actually more spread out now. So we have people who are early starters, but we also have people who start later but finish later as well. So the capacity for clients is more. We obviously looked at our billable hours, and the amount of time that we spent on billable work was higher during the 4-day trial compared to the exact same month the year prior. And that wasn't a growth of clients thing. That was comparing it to the same set of clients, and the billable, because people are focusing their time more on client work, they're prioritizing their diaries, you know, they're going to people and having the conversations quickly with them rather than 10 emails. Like, they're just more productive. It just works, and I'm in it, I know it works, and I know it would work anywhere else I work. But for me, it's around the dedication of business owners and senior leadership teams to their people. If they want to create better environments for their people, they can. And for me, it's a mindset thing, as Ian's just said.
Yeah, and just to build on that, Sinead, so you mentioned the productivity element, which is obviously a massive one, but outside of that, the attraction of new staff and, you know, the CVs we get through, and the retention of the team at a time when you've got a massive shortage of skill set in our sector, you've got salary inflation going through the roof. I kind of feel like a lot of agencies have problems around on the people side. We're almost immune to that, which means that we can focus on other elements, and we haven't got this big thing hanging over us.
That's so very true.
Someone will probably email in and tell me I've got the wrong person for this, but I think it was Henry Ford who said, there is a better way, find it. Yeah. And I find it so strange. Like, I find it weird that people are wedded to a 5-day week as the only way of doing it. It's a Victorian construct, right? You know, the Victorians invented a 5-day working week. Initially, it was sort of 6 days out, but as the Industrial Revolution moved on, the Sabbath was always sacrosanct and nobody really worked on a Sunday. But as that sort of became really nailed down as a Victorian concept, but it used to be half day Wednesday and you'd work Saturday morning. So it was still, you know, the 5-day working week. I think Sheffield Wednesday, I called Sheffield Wednesday because they played on Wednesdays during the half day factory closing. This Victorian construct, which has over time evolved in itself, in that, you know, can you think of anyone or anywhere that does half day Wednesday closing now? I remember banks used to shut half day Wednesdays, post offices. And then you go, you know, I could take my passbook as a kid down to take my money out on a Saturday morning because they're open then. So that 5-day working week has evolved to sort of 5/7 for lots of industries and lots of people. But the fact that no one looks at this and goes, yeah, but we're not means of production stood in a wool mill in Bradford looming and spinning things anymore, right? We're doing things with our head, not with our hands in lots of industries. Surely we can use our heads to make things better.
Yeah, and I think it was Henry Ford. So Henry Ford is one of the first people to go from 6 days to 5 days. But I'm sure I remember hearing that one of his motivations was because he actually wanted people to be able to travel more than where they needed a car. So he actually, you know, whatever, you know.
Henry Ford realized that some of the people who might most want to buy the vehicles that he was producing were the people who worked in his factories. And by standards of his day, paid quite highly. And sort of made better of it by shipping more units out the door, because he pretty much invented production lines as well, didn't he? But paid people well and gave them time to travel so that they could get in the car and travel to places. You know, it's a revolutionary.
I think a massive part of this as well is, as you say, the 5-day work week was built in an age where A lot of the time, one parent worked as well. So in families, there was a person who stayed home, took care of children, grandparents, the home, the lifestyle. Whereas now we have a lot of stay-at-home dads. We have dads who do childcare. We have mums who do childcare. We have, you know, it's a very different world. And I think all of the added stresses and pressures of life in this day and age, to have that, we call it life admin day, because to have that extra one day where you can focus on getting the shopping in or getting the house pulled together, walking the dogs, focusing on your own well-being and mental health, it just screams volumes for who you work for and what they actually think about you as a person. I mean, I could talk about the four-day work week all
I think it's a really positive move. Now, I at Eczema, we don't have a 4-day working week. Aoife works 4 days, I work 5 days. And I'm not in the excuse mode, but when you, there's two people, and I am, as it sort of Ian was in 2014, I'm doing a little bit of all sorts. I'm finance, I'm admin, I'm this and that and the other, and I'm managing client days. But I use a phrase, as I have done for years, that I manage my energy, not my time. So if I decide, as I did, I was like, I'm just having the day off, or I'm stopping working at 1 p.m. it doesn't affect, you know, as long as I've done the things I need to do for clients. So I don't have we're shut this day, but I manage my energy very closely, because there's no point burning out and then not being able to do any work, right? It's pointless.
Yeah. I mean, just a good example of that. Like, who can seriously say that when we used to sit in an office 5 days a week, come Friday, 12 o'clock, it wasn't a case of pub? Yes. And then you would go back to work, pretend to do work for like 3 or 4 hours. And then, you know, you might have a few beers after work. Like, the whole thing was a joke, but nobody would just accept it for what it was. And we'd play this little game. Bit weird.
Yeah. There used to be, in the early days of, I think it was lastminute.com. Rolling back to early days of the internet, I remember scrolling for a holiday during work on a Friday afternoon. They knew the game that people were playing, and there was a button at the top of their site that the boss is coming. And if you clicked it, it just pushed a spreadsheet across the whole screen. So it looked like you were just putting data into an Excel spreadsheet. And like, you know, work has never been this place where everyone is 100% active from 9 a.m. Monday morning through till 5 p.m. Friday afternoon, is it? You know, we manage peaks and troughs through that.
There's been loads of research into this. Like, the average number of productive hours per week is ridiculously low, much lower than what anybody would think. It's something like 12 to 15 hours.
Yeah.
In a good week. Sinead, sorry, you were going to say?
No, and I was just going to say, it's about how you feel as well. You know, I've been in HR the majority of my career, but I've worked in roles where I have been frightened to pick my phone up to check if my kids are okay at school, or, you know, can I just have a quick toilet break? And it's about treating people like adults and not, you know, for what they churn out. It's genuinely about outcomes and you know, what people achieve. I don't care how many hours someone focuses on something for, as long as they deliver on what they need to deliver. Yeah. If their mental well-being has taken a hit because of work, then that's not right. And that, obviously, we are people first and we do push that message. And I think the good ones that they come, a lot of people, let's face it, in the digital world, they come from other agencies and they come to us and they have stories. They may leave us and have stories, but genuinely they come and they're like, oh, this happened. And that, you know, you hear of these, even other workplaces. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, if people feel like they're respected, they're trusted, and they're well looked after, you'll get that respect and trust back.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you've built this agency, 60 people-ish. You're working on the culture to make sure all the internal stuff's right. And you've made some changes recently to how the agency is structured externally in terms of the performance side of things. So do you want to talk to us, Ian, about the new brands that have appeared? And then we'll talk about a partnership that you've struck up with a gobby, plucky little agency out of Belfast and Liverpool.
Yeah, of course. So when we started the agency, we didn't have this current plan that I'll talk about in a second in mind. This has kind of been the result of historic work. So the story here is, we in our second year of business, we won Best SEO Campaign at the UK Search Awards, and it was for an automotive client. And it was a fantastic case study. The results were just off the charts. We effectively helped to build what is now the UK's largest car leasing company through organic search. As a result of that piece of work, we then started to get a lot of inquiries from the automotive sector, which has led us to working with, you know, multiple manufacturers, retail dealership groups, you know, other companies in the leasing space. And that over time has resulted in the automotive element being a pretty significant chunk of the agency's revenue. And we had two options at this point. We started discussing whether we lean into that more and we double down on the automotive experience, or because that comes with risk. I mean, like what we've seen with the semiconductor issues, and you know, the wires that go in cars have been a shortage there, and that has a knock-on effect on that sector. So we don't want to be too exposed to a sector, or we continue, you know, being a bit more of a broad proposition as a search marketing agency. We recently took the decision to double down, and we've launched a sub-brand, which is a performance marketing agency aimed at the automotive sector. And that is taking the people within the team who have worked on multiple automotive accounts, effectively putting them to one side and starting afresh, and with the view of attracting more clients in that space. In the background to that, I'd say our second kind of highest revenue sector is probably the home and garden space. So we've started Evolved Home. So Upshift is the automotive brand. Evolved Home is the home and garden space. So it's a similar kind of plan. It's kind of in the incubation stage, whereas Upshift is very much, you know, that is getting the marketing budget, that is getting the big push, all the rest of it. But with time, Upshift will, you know, be very well established, and then home and garden comes through, and then, you know, we are thinking of a third sector as well. So it's a bit of a, you know, it'll be a transition period, but what it will do is it will allow us to attract people into the agency who have a genuine interest in the automotive space, which, you know, we might struggle to attract that kind of talent now.
I want to ask you a branding question, and I know as an SEO fan, who came through, probably branding's one of those words where you're just going to put your head in your hands and go, okay. So from a sort of a brand management point of view, you've got the Evolved group of the Evolved parent brand. You've got a sub-brand, Evolved Home, which also uses the Evolved name. But then your other sub-brand, the automotive one, doesn't use the Evolved name. So you've kind of gone halfway into a house of brands, but halfway into a branded house. What was the thinking behind that?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And there was a lot of discussion behind the scenes, as you can imagine. Before we take this decision, I think we I couldn't imagine how many hours, maybe it's more dozens and dozens of hours, and we had a lot of disagreement along the way, and ultimately I think what drove it was for this to be a powerful, unique proposition that didn't just look like a marketing ploy, because it, whilst it has the marketing benefits, you know, this was actually going to impact everything we did. Like I said, the team, for example, it had to stand on its own two legs and had to be its own thing. And obviously that was getting the bulk of the marketing budget. The Evolved Home wasn't quite there. So we couldn't, it would have been very high risk to try and launch two sub brands at the same time. We had to prove the concept with one brand to begin with, and then we could look at rolling that out. So I think that was primarily we didn't want it to look like a gimmickly, you know, like a just something that looks good on paper when actually behind the scenes it just continues as per normal.
Yeah. Okay. It was an interesting discussion, which I love talking brands at various points. So it's all good that way. Yeah.
And there's nothing to say that we've got it right, by the way, at this point. I mean, this only launched, quite recently, a couple of months ago. So, you know, time will tell.
There's probably brand strategists listening who hate me for saying this, but I do think sometimes it's overthought. I don't care what the brand is. It's what you do with it from the day that the artwork arrives. that's what matters. Not, you know, I say this over and over again, nobody sensible would listen to their brand agency come and pitch the word Virgin as a name for a company. Nobody, you're looking and got, lads, get out the door, will you? But look at Virgin as a company, you know, airlines, banks, it's been in fizzy drinks, trains. It works because of what you do afterwards, not what you do up to the point where you sign it off and everyone strokes a beard and look at the presentation and go, oh, wow, that's wonderful. Yeah. It's what you do next that counts.
Yeah. And the other thing is nobody has all of the answers to begin with when you go through this process. We were quite fortunate.
I would disagree. I would say you're just talking to the wrong people. I have most of the answers to everything.
Well, to be fair, there were some case studies of other agencies who had kind of created a niche brand in certain sectors that we did lean on quite heavily when we were doing our research as evidence of, you know, this working. But even that's a flawed process because you rarely hear of the ones that didn't work. So, you know, you have to be a little bit careful.
We will come back to about the stuff that didn't work in a minute because I'm going to ask you both about a big cock-up or a mistake you got involved in at work. So we'll come back to that. But before we do, I also want to talk about one of the other things that you're looking at as you are now. What's your new job title? Is it Lord and Master of Evolved or something like that? Or a CEO? Sorry, I got it wrong. But it is partnerships and expansions and things like that, which brings us to a conversation about Eximo and Evolved, who are now, as we announced relatively recently, working a little bit closer together. We have a partnership together. I'll let you carry on talking about that a little bit before I weigh in and talk about myself.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a lot of overlap between the kind of work that we do from a strategic point of view and the kind of clients we have, and also elements that and skill sets within the business that, you know, we might be missing or are fairly weak on that you actually have. And, you know, you help us out on multiple things, you know, whether it's working with speakers, whether it's casting your set of eyes over, you know, different strategic decisions that are being made and vice versa. You know, I think we plug a bit of a gap with some of the challenges you're facing. And, you know, I think we also get on well. There's a good relationship between the teams. We had done, you know, pieces of work over the years together. So we knew that as two different entities, you know, we could work well together. So it just kind of made sense to, you know, crystallize that a little bit more and get something formal in place and see how it goes.
Absolutely. I think that the key thing for me with this was that when we'd worked together before, there's a value alignment, the way you approach clients, staff, you know, whether it's social or even, you know, critiquing work that we've done together, always felt like a positive experience. You know, when nobody gets anything right perfectly the first time, and there were bits as we were working together that needed to be pushed back and improved and sent back and challenged with you as well, and that always felt like a really supportive place and a supportive process. So, and as we push in at Eximo to do more with manufacturers who are looking to get into direct to consumer, you can see straight away one of the big gaps that I have as a small consultancy here is, you know, we can talk all day about helping companies get their product in front of customers, but if we don't actually help them get it in front of customers, they're not going to sell anything, which means you need performance marketing skill generally, as well as many other things. But being able to work with Evolve to plug that gap, but also being able to then parachute in, it sounds like some sort of hero of work, which is not what I'm doing, but coming into work with your team on some of your clients and just providing a bit of outside perspective and a slightly different view is hopefully beneficial for you as well, but certainly really beneficial for me.
Yeah, definitely. And other things that we've not touched upon, things like events, you know, you are well known in the speaker space. It's an area that we want to get into, start running our own events. And when we looked at that, we were all on the same page. There's nobody better that we can think of, whether we'd worked with you in the past or not. You know, you were kind of the person that we would want involved in this. So.
And I love the sound of my own voice, which is why I ended up starting a podcast. So then there we are. So yeah, the partnership has been, we announced it fairly recently, and generally speaking, in really simple terms, I'll be working with some of Evolve's clients whenever they need a little bit of outside thinking. And as we go forward and start working with companies that want to take products to market, you'll be meeting Evolve on the other side of that and working with their teams who know what they're doing, right? You know, their client roster, which is on their website. We don't need to talk about it, but, you know, I've gone have a look at the website, some of the case studies, some of the awards. Sinead, a number of awards won in the last couple of years. Is it in the thousands yet, or how many is it?
I mean, the people ones are nearly there, just saying. Yeah, awards for culture, we've done really, really well in the last year. I mean, awards in general during lockdown as a business, marketing awards, absolutely phenomenal.
Well, you said people awards, and you're underplaying it, as I think you always do, but great places to work. Where did you land with that?
Best workplace for women in the UK.
Well, I mean,
number one.
That's a hell of a brag to downplay a little bit there. So, you know, look, number one there. And I think overall you were in the top.
So we got number 11. It was very bittersweet. We were based, it was based on last year's numbers. So they kind of work a year beyond. So the awards that we're winning now are based on this year's cycle. So they basically survey our whole team. This is nothing me, Ian, Dave, Tom, Haley, none of the directors or senior leadership team actually have an input on this. So they survey the whole team, and then all of the numbers for the year are generated based on what the team have said we're doing and how they feel. So last year we were ranked 11, but that was on the small category. The best workplace for women, number one, that was ranked on this year's scores. So that was in the medium category. So we were up against some fairly large businesses. I think Sage was on there for their UK branch. And some other large digital agencies as well. We were number two for tech, best workplace in tech as well. And then we applied and didn't think we'd get anywhere. We were shortlisted for three CIPD awards, and we won the Excellence in SME People Practice as well. So we were up against Mental Health Matters and some large other agencies as well. So really, really over the moon with those. But it's not accolades. We don't want to rack them up. It is genuinely like, a lot of the results for great places to work, which is why we do it. It comes from the people. It comes from what, you know, genuinely what people feel about us. And I'm constantly saying to people, like, get a review on Glassdoor for us, because that's where people want to go. They want to understand what a lot of companies, not necessarily digital agencies, have some fantastic perks and some fantastic benefits. But sometimes when you're in a role, it has to be right for you. And the culture isn't always right when you move into it, or not everything's as it seems. We sound fantastic on paper. And it's really hard to say to people who don't or haven't worked in this environment before that we genuinely do give people the time for training, the time for charity, you know, the social time. People are like, yeah, but I've heard that before and it hasn't really resonated when I've been in the workplace. And it, you know, we need people to get that out for us. And we're getting there with Glassdoor. But yeah, it's about asking our people to just tell people how it truly is. And that speaks volumes over any other award that we could get, really.
Yeah. And you know, alongside that, so they've got the People Awards, which are great, and some really brilliant numbers. Some people get snooty about awards and, like, you know, it's only from the people who enter. And it's and look, it is. There are problems with awards, undoubtedly. But there are external recognition of things that are going on, whether it's the EU Search Awards, UK Search Awards, or, you know, some of the marketing awards you're going in for, or the Great Places to Work and CIPD Awards. It's external recognition of the things that you are doing. So while they are not the means, they are a great end to get to. So, congratulations on that. A lot of work goes into that. So, and I don't mean filling the form in. I mean, to that point where people, you know, to win those. Yeah. So as we start to wrap up, I've got two questions. I'm going to come to you first, Sinead. Let's talk about something that you got wrong. Let's just have a laugh. It's coming up to Christmas. Let's find out something you did that went wrong. What did you learn from it?
Many things. In HR specifically, you have to be very careful who you trust. In this environment, I can talk to anyone. I can tell everyone. And this is one of the things that I love about working at Evolve. I could go and talk to an exec about what the SLT plans are and what we're thinking and because if it doesn't happen, they know we're trying. And that's, we don't have a hierarchy working here. Everybody has a level and they understand from a competency perspective where they're working to. But in terms of who you can talk to, I can, you know, you can trust anyone. You can bounce ideas off anyone, which is brilliant, especially in some of the, we have a small team, a small people team. But the biggest thing for me, I guess, across my career was in previous roles, talking to the wrong people, not speaking to the right stakeholders, bouncing ideas off people that didn't really matter and not getting investment, I guess, in where I needed it. And also being really critical of myself when I've made a typo or a confidentiality error when it comes to, you know, mass letters or disciplinaries, that kind of thing. I've made many, many of those errors.
Well, if it's any help when it comes to that, I once sent a mailer out when I worked at Durham County Cricket Club to about 80,000 people, maybe 85,000 people. And just to do a couple of checks before we sent it, I had to sort all the data just to make sure I'd got it right. So I sorted it all. There was a couple of things we had to check, like we'd got the chairman right and various bits and bobs before we sent it. So I checked all that, sent it off, and off we went. What I'd actually done is sort just the last name column, not the whole spreadsheet. So 85,000, whatever it was, went out, and everyone's last name was wrong on the database. So all that happened was after that, the phone lit up in the box office and they were like, oh, we're going to be selling loads of tickets. But it was like, no, hi, my name's Andy Jarvis. You've sent me this thing to Andy McIntosh. Have you got my details right? No, yeah, we have. Sorry. Okay. Phone rings again. Hello, my name's Sinead Hall. You've sent me this thing for Sinead Jarvis. Yeah. 3 weeks of non-stop phone calls. We had Sir Bobby Robson's PA ring up at one point saying, you know, he's a friend of the cricket club, but any chance you can get his name right?
Salary
good
letters.
One. Good one.
Salary letters. Adding the wrong salary to someone's letter or putting the wrong name to someone's salary. You just, it's a massive fuck up, but you learn from it. And this is, I tell, Shannon's my HR assistant, and she's fairly new to her career, but she's shit hot at these things as well. She's so pernickety with attention to detail, which is phenomenal in a HR person. But I constantly check her and I'm like, I'm sorry, this isn't you, this is me, because I know where I, and this is where intelligent failure comes in. You will never forget it. You never.
Mine wasn't an intelligent failure, was it? It was just a failure, but that's all. I learned a lot. And listen, any mailing, any emails, there's all, you know, I have a check process now. So I learned from it and nobody died. But that's, Ian, what about you? Come on, Ian, there must be something.
Oh, I mean, Christ, I feel like I could write a book on mistakes I've made, some big and serious, some just stupid and funny. But I think there's a saying, which is, what got you here won't get you there. And I think I was quite late to actually realize that.
I read that yesterday, literally.
Oh, really? Yeah. So when we started the agency, I had this weird romantic idea that some of the early hires would then go on to be, you know, the seniors, the heads of, maybe even directors in the business. And then with time, you have a lot of evidence in front of you that suggests that actually they're not the right people for the role. And then you either have to hire above that individual. And when you're obviously a small, tight-knit team, that can be quite difficult because actually you're quite pally with everybody in the team. Or you need both hopefully come to the decision where actually it's best for, you know, this person to move on to a different role. And I think I was just way too keen to try and keep everybody together and to keep everybody happy. And what happened as a result is that, you know, the business will suffer in one way or another if somebody's not right for that role.
So yeah, it's true, isn't it? And it is, you know, people say, oh, you know, these are people at work, they're not your mates. But when you work in a small business, that's not true, is it? You know, you're spending so much time with these people and winning together, losing together. It's kind of, you form a bond, and it's really difficult to move through that.
And sometimes the company outgrows people, and sometimes it's the other way around. Sometimes the individual might outgrow the company, or they're just at a different stage of life and they want, you know, other things. So just about having that honest conversation and not trying to force something together.
Definitely. And my last question then, I ask everyone, and I don't even think I tipped you off about this, but books, do you have any book recommendations for people? We always ask this at the end. If you're interested in something, learning some more about some of the things we've talked about, or just a book that was really useful for you during your career, any recommendations that you would say for people?
There's one that I recommended in the last agency update, which was 5 Dysfunctions of a Team. Very famous. Oh, really? Sorry, Sinead. In that case, that's our recommendation. you've got to go and read it now. Because that actually covers up a lot of what we've spoken about today around culture, about trust, around psychological safety. And I think if people understand all of that, you know, everything else just fits into place.
Yeah, perfect. No, well, look, well, you can have that as a joint recommendation between the two of you. There we are, 5 Dysfunctions of the Team. And there's a link, if you are listening, in the show notes to click on that and it'll just take you straight on. So you can go and have a look, see if you can get it. Listen, thank you very much for your time. If you, so that's Ian and Sinead from Evolved. If you're listening, thank you very much. We'll be back in 2023 with the same old stuff, the same jokes, the same questions, for same sort of structure to the podcast. We are about to announce the kind of Spotify Wrapped spot for the strategy sessions. Basically, it's an email that we're going to put out with the top 5 episodes on between Christmas and New Year that we're going to write this afternoon. So this episode won't be in that because we've pulled all the data already. So you're not going to be in the top episodes of the year, unfortunately. But thank you for listening. If you've been along for the whole year, if you're just new to this episode, because I've got 2 great guests here, thank you for coming. Have a listen to the back catalogue. There's some great stuff. There's probably about 45, 50 hours now of me talking and the same shit jokes. So thank you very much and have a very Merry Christmas, everyone. Bye.